detects and detects threat, which biologically sets off the neural circuitry that allows him to survive a threat from his environment, to fight, to flee, to freeze, or to faint. His downstairs brain springs into action, preparing to react quickly rather than fully considering alternatives in a more responsive, receptive state. His muscles might tense as he prepares to defend himself, and if necessary, attack with freeze and fight. Or he may run away in flight, or collapse in a fainting response. Each of these is a pathway of reactivity of the downstairs brain, and his thinking, rational, self-control circuitry of the upstairs brain goes offline, becoming unavailable in that moment. That's the key. We can't be in both a reactive downstairs state and a receptive upstairs state at the same time. The downstairs reactivity holds sway. In this situation, you can appeal to your child's more sophisticated upstairs brain and allow it to help rein in the more reactive downstairs brain. By demonstrating respect for your child, nurturing him with lots of empathy, and remaining open to collaborative and reflective discussions, you communicate no threat, so the reptilian brain can relax its reactivity. In doing so, you activate the upstairs circuits, including the extremely important prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for calm decision-making and controlling emotions and impulses. That's how we move from reactivity to receptivity, and that's what we want to teach our children to do. So instead of fiercely demanding that your 5-year-old calm down, you can help quiet and soothe the downstairs brain, and instead bring the upstairs brain online by gently inviting him to be physically close to you and listening to whatever he's upset about. If you're in a public place and your child is disturbing everyone around you, it may be necessary to take him outside while you attempt to appeal to his upstairs brain. Research supports this strategy of engaging the upstairs brain rather than enraging the downstairs. We've seen, for example, that when a person is shown a photo of a face that's angry or afraid, activity increases in a region of the downstairs brain called the amygdala, which is responsible for quickly processing and expressing strong emotions, especially anger and fear. One of the amygdala's primary jobs is to remain alert and to sound an alarm any time we are threatened, allowing us to act quickly. Interestingly, simply seeing a photograph of a person with an angry or frightened face causes the viewer's amygdala to activate. In fact, even if the viewer sees the photo so quickly that he or she isn't consciously aware of having seen the picture, a subliminal instinctual emotional reaction causes the amygdala to fire or become active. What's even more fascinating about the study is that when viewers were asked to label the emotion in the picture and named it as fear or anger, their amygdala immediately became less active. Why? Because part of the upstairs brain, a part called the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex, took charge with the labeling and then processed the emotion, allowing the thinking, analytical part of the brain to take over and soothe the irritated lower regions rather than letting the reactive, emotional downstairs brain dominate and dictate the person's feelings and responses. This is a classic example of the name it to tame it strategy we discuss in detail in The Whole Brain Child. Simply by naming the emotion, a person feels her levels of fear and anger decrease. That's how the upstairs brain can calm the downstairs brain, and that's a skill that can last a lifetime. This is what we want to do for our kids when they become upset and act out. Help them engage their upstairs brain. The prefrontal part of the upstairs brain actually has soothing fibers that can calm the lower regions when they are reactive. The key is to grow them well in our children and to activate them in a moment of distress by first connecting before redirecting. We want our kids to develop the internal skill to calm the storm and reflect on what's happening inside. Think back about the functions of the upstairs brain. Good decision-making, control over emotions and body, flexibility, empathy, self-understanding, and morality. These are the aspects of our kids' character we want to develop, right? As we put it in the whole brain child, we want to engage the upstairs brain rather than enraging the downstairs brain. Engage, don't enrage. When we enrage the downstairs brain, that's usually because our amygdala is firing as well. And guess what the amygdala wants to do? Win. So when the amygdala in both the parent and the child are firing at top speed, both looking to win, it's virtually always going to be a dramatic battle that ends with both sides losing. No one will win, and relational casualties will litter the battlefield. All because we enrage the downstairs rather than engaging the upstairs. To use a different metaphor, it's as if you have a remote control for your child, and you have the power, at least to some extent, to determine what kind of a response you'll receive when you two interact. Press the engage button, the calm down and think button, and you'll appeal to the upstairs brain, activating a calm response. But push the enrage button, the freak out and escalate emotions button, by using threats and demands, and you'll be practically begging for the fighting part of the brain to click into action. You'll poke the lizard and get a reptilian reactive response. It's up to you which button to press. Remember, none of this is to excuse parents from the responsibility of setting boundaries and clearly communicating expectations. We'll give you lots of practical suggestions for doing so in the coming pages. But as you set those boundaries and communicate those expectations, you'll make things much easier on yourself, your child, and anyone else within shouting range if you appeal to your child's wiser and receptive self and her upstairs brain, as opposed to her lizard reactiveness and her downstairs brain. What's even more exciting is what happens after we appeal to the upstairs brain. When it gets engaged repeatedly, it becomes strong. Neurons that fire together, wire together. So when a child is in an upset state of mind and we invite the upstairs brain to become active, we create a functional linkage between that dysregulated state and an activation of the part of her brain that brings her back into a well-regulated state. We can likely grow those soothing fibers that extend from the prefrontal upstairs brain into the downstairs brain. That means the more we appeal to our child's more integrated nature, the more we ask her to think before she acts, or to consider someone else's feelings, the more we ask her to act ethically or empathically, then the more she'll use her upstairs brain. And the stronger it will become because it is building connections and becoming more integrated with the downstairs areas. Using her upstairs brain will more and more become her accessible pathway, her automatic default, even when emotions run high. As a result, she'll become better and better at making good decisions, handling her emotions, and caring for others. Applying the brain C's. Let's talk now about what the three brain C's, changing, changeable, and complex, look like in action. When Nina freaked out on the porch step, Liz's first instinct was to logically explain how the transportation decisions had been made. Your sister's school is right by my work. She could have gone on to explain that Tim had more time to drive Nina to her school, and that Nina had just yesterday been asking for more time with her father. All of these statements were true and rational. However, as we've said, when a child is in the throes of a meltdown, logic will often be ineffective, sometimes even counterproductive. This is what Liz recognized as she looked at her fury-filled daughter. In effect, what she realized was the first of the three brain C's. Nina's brain was changing. It was developing, not developed, developing, which meant that Liz needed to be patient with her little girl and not expect her to consistently control herself like an adult, or even like an older child. She took a deep breath and worked to remain calm despite the stress being produced by the unreasonable 4-year-old, the impatient 7-year-old, and the ever-ticking clock. Just as important in this situation was the second brain C, that the brain is changeable. Liz understood that the way she and her husband handled each situation with their daughters wired the girls' developing brains, for good or for bad. So in this moment of awareness, Liz resisted the urge she currently felt, which was to hurriedly and even aggressively pick up her crying daughter, march her to Tim's car, stomping all the way, strap her into the car seat, and slam the door. By the way, if you recognize yourself in the anger-filled depiction of how Liz wanted to handle the situation, you're not alone. We've all been there. Listen to When a Parenting Expert Loses It at the end of the audio. Caring parents will often condemn themselves over every little mistake they make, or for every time they miss an opportunity to approach a difficult moment from a whole-brain perspective. We urge you to listen to this internal critic only long enough to gain some awareness so that you can do better the next time, but then be generous and forgiving of yourself. Of course you want to do your best with and for your kids, but as we'll explain in detail in the book's conclusion, even parental mistakes can be extremely valuable for our kids. We can teach them we are all human and we can take responsibility for what happens and make a repair. That's an essential teaching experience for all children. Liz was human and a parent, so of course she made her share of mistakes, as we all do. But in this instance, she disciplined from a no-drama, whole-brain frame of mind and made an intentional decision to take a moment and be there emotionally for her young daughter. By this point, the family was less than 1 minute behind schedule. And Liz realized that even though Nina's feelings seemed dramatic, they were real. She needed her mom right then. So Liz denied the impulse to do what was easiest and quickest, and again pulled her daughter close to her. As for specifically how she responded to the situation, that's where the third brain C, complex, comes in. Liz understood her daughter well enough to know better than to enrage the downstairs brain. It was plenty active already. Instead, she needed to engage Nina's upstairs brain. The first step, though, had to be to connect. Before redirecting, we always connect. That's what Liz was doing when she held her daughter. Yes, she was in a hurry, but nothing positive could happen until Nina calmed down some, which didn't take long once she was in her mother's arms. In just a few seconds, Liz felt Nina take a deep breath and her little body begin to soften. If Nina were your child, you might have handled this situation in one of a few ways depending on your style and her temperament. Like Liz, you would probably seek as your first goal to help your daughter calm down so that her upstairs brain would come back online and she could listen to reason. You might promise to get up early tomorrow morning so you'd have time to take her to school. Or you might assure her that you'd ask your boss if you could leave work early this afternoon so you could pick up your daughter and then have some one-on-one special time with her. Or you might offer to tell her a story on speakerphone from your car as her dad drove her to school. As it turned out, Liz tried several of these strategies, all to no avail. No creative inspiration hit the mark. Nina was having none of it. Aren't you glad we didn't use an example in which that situation worked out nicely and perfectly? You're relieved, aren't you? Because you know it doesn't always go that way. No matter how skillfully we handle a situation, and no matter how cognizant we remain of important information like the three brain C's, at times our kids still don't do things the way we'd like. They don't pick up their toys. They don't automatically apologize to their brother. They don't calm down, which is exactly what happened here. Nina would not cooperate. Listening to her feelings, holding her, coming up with a plan, nothing did the trick. But Liz still had to leave for work, and the kids had to get to school. So remaining calm and empathic, that's our goal, she explained that they had to go, and that Tim would drive her to school this morning as planned. I know you're sad, and I understand that you want to ride with me. I would like that too. But we can't make that work today. Would you like to climb in, or would you like Daddy to help you get in the car now? Daddy will be with you to comfort you on the way to school. I love you, and I'll see you this afternoon. And with that, the front porch situation ended with Tim holding a crying Nina as he carried her to his car. Notice what we're acknowledging here. No drama discipline can't ensure that your kids will act the way you'd like every time you address their behavior. The whole brain approach definitely gives you a much better chance of achieving the short-term goal of encouraging cooperation from your children. It also helps remove or at least reduce the most explosive emotions in the situation, de-escalating the drama and thus avoiding the harm and hurt that result when a parent yells or personalizes the issue. But it won't always be effective at getting the exact behavior you hope for. Kids are human beings, after all, who have their own emotions, desires, and agendas. They're not computers we program to do what we want. But at the very least, as we're sure you'll agree after you hear the following chapters, no drama discipline gives you a much better chance of communicating with your children in ways that feel better to both of you, build trust and respect between you, and decrease the drama in most discipline situations. What's more, a whole brain approach provides a way to show our kids how much we love and respect them, even as we discipline them. They know, and we reinforce it over and over throughout their lives, that when they're upset or acting inappropriately, we're going to be there for them and with them. We don't turn our back or reject them when they're distressed. We don't say or even imply that their happiness is a condition they must meet to receive our love. No drama discipline allows us to communicate to our children, "I'm with you. I've got your back." Even when you're at your worst and I don't like the way you're acting, I love you and I'm here for you. I understand you're having a hard time, and I am here. No parent can communicate this message all the time in every scenario, but we can send it consistently and repeatedly so there's never any question in our children's minds. This kind of predictable, sensitive, loving relational discipline allows kids to feel safe. As a result, they have the freedom to become independent individuals whose brains are wired in such a way that they are better able to think through decisions, comprehend what they actually feel about a situation, consider others' perspectives, and come to a sound conclusion on their own. In other words, the experiences of emotional and physical safety give them the capacity to act responsibly and make good choices. In contrast, a parenting style focused on control and fear, stressing that a child needs to toe the line all the time, undermines that feeling of safety. If a child lives in constant worry that he might mess up and make his parents unhappy or that he'll be punished, he won't feel the freedom to do all the things that grow and strengthen his upstairs brain. Considering others' feelings, exploring alternative actions, understanding himself, and trying to make the best decision in a given situation. We don't want our discipline to cause our children to focus all their energy and neural resources on making us happy or staying out of trouble. Instead, we want our discipline to help grow our kids' upstairs brains, and that's just what no drama discipline does. No drama discipline builds the brain. The three brain C's lead to one crucial and undeniable conclusion, which is the central notion of this chapter. No drama discipline actually helps build the brain. That's right. It's not only that a whole brain approach can diffuse difficult and highly charged situations with your kids, or that it will help you build your relationship with them as you more clearly communicate how much you love them and that they are safe, even as you set boundaries for their behavior. All that's true. The discipline principles and strategies we'll show you really do offer all of those benefits, making your day-to-day life easier and less stressful while nurturing your relationship with your child. But beyond all that, no drama discipline actually builds a child's brain. It strengthens neural connections between the upstairs and downstairs parts of the brain, and these connections lead to personal insight, responsibility, flexible decision-making, empathy, and morality. The reason is that when we help strengthen the connective fibers between the upstairs and downstairs, the higher parts of the brain can communicate with and override a child's primitive impulses more and more often. And our disciplinary decisions go a long way toward determining how strong those connections are. The way we interact with our kids when they're upset significantly affects how their brains develop, and therefore what kind of people they are, both today and in the years to come. This is how our way of communicating with our children impacts their internal skills, which are embedded in the connections in their changing, changeable, and complex brains. It makes perfect sense when you think about it. Every time we give a child the experience of exercising his upstairs brain, it gets stronger and more fully developed. When we ask him questions that develop insight into himself, he becomes more insightful. For example, when you're angry, where do you feel it in your body? When we encourage her to empathize with someone else, she becomes more empathic. I wonder how Janie felt when she heard what you said. When we give a child the opportunity to decide how he should act rather than simply telling him what he should do, he becomes a better decision maker. That's a tough one. What do you think you should do to make things right? And that's one of the ultimate goals of parenting, isn't it? That our kids become more insightful, empathic, and able to make good decisions on their own. You know the old saying, give a man a fish and he'll eat for a day. Teach a man to fish and he'll eat for a lifetime. Our ultimate goal isn't that our children do what we want them to do because we're watching them or telling them what to do. That would be fairly impractical, after all, unless we plan on living and going to work with them for the rest of their lives. Rather, we want to help them learn to make positive and productive choices on their own in whatever situation they face. And that means we need to view the times they misbehave as opportunities to give them practice building important skills and having those experiences wired into the brain. Building the brain by setting limits. This perspective can completely change the way we look at the opportunities we have to help our kids make better choices. When we set limits, we help develop the parts of the upstairs brain that allow children to control themselves and regulate their behaviors and their body. One way to think about it is that we're helping our kids develop the ability to shift between the different aspects of what's called the autonomic nervous system. One part of the autonomic nervous system is the sympathetic branch, which you can think of as the accelerator of the system. Like a gas pedal, it causes us to react with gusto to impulses and situations as it primes the body for action. The other part is the parasympathetic branch, which serves as the brakes of the system and allows us to stop and regulate ourselves and our impulses. Keeping the accelerator and the brakes in balance is key for emotional regulation. So, when we help children develop the capacity to control themselves even when they're upset, we're helping them learn to balance these two branches of the autonomic nervous system. Purely in terms of brain functioning, sometimes an activated accelerator, which might result in a child's inappropriate and impulsive action, followed by the sudden application of brakes, in the form of parental limit setting, leads to a nervous system response that may cause the child to stop and feel a sense of shame. When this happens, the physiologic manifestation might result in avoiding eye contact, feeling a heaviness in her chest, and possibly experiencing a sinking feeling in her stomach. Parents might describe this by saying she feels bad about what she's done. This initial awareness of having crossed a line is extremely healthy, and it's evidence of a child's developing upstairs brain. Some scientists suggest that limit setting that creates a healthy sense of shame leads to an internal compass to guide future behavior. It means she's beginning to acquire a conscience or an inner voice along with an understanding of morality and self-control. Over time, as her parents repeatedly help her recognize the moments when she needs to put on the brakes, her behavior begins to change. It's more than simply learning that a particular action is bad or that her parents don't like what she's done, so she'd better avoid that action or she'll get in trouble. More occurs within this child than just learning the rules of good versus bad or acceptable versus unacceptable. Rather, her brain actually changes, and her nervous system gets wired to tell her what feels right, which modifies her future behavior. New experiences wire new connections among her neurons, and the changes in the circuitry of her brain fundamentally and positively alter the way she interacts with her world. The way her parents help this process along is by lovingly and empathically teaching her which behaviors are acceptable and which aren't. That's why it's essential that we set limits and that our children internalize no when necessary, particularly in the early years when the regulatory circuits of the brain are wiring up. By helping them understand the rules and limits in their respective environments, we help build their conscience. This is often difficult for a loving parent. We want our kids to be happy, and we like it when they receive what they desire. Plus, we're aware of how quickly a pleasant situation can devolve when a child doesn't get what he wants. However, if we truly love our kids and want what's best for them, we need to be able to tolerate the tension and discomfort they and we may experience when we set a limit. We want to say yes to our children as often as possible, but sometimes saying no is the most loving thing we can do. One caveat here. Many parents say no, or a form of it, far too often. They say it automatically, often when it's not necessary. Stop touching that balloon. No running. Don't spill. Our point here isn't that we want our kids to hear the word no a lot. In fact, much more effective than an outright no is a yes with a condition. Yes, you can take a bath later. Or, yes, we'll read another story, but we'll need to do it tomorrow. The point, in other words, is not to make a point of saying no, but to understand the importance of helping kids recognize limits so that they become increasingly better at putting on the brakes themselves when necessary. A second caveat is important to note here, too. When limit setting and no are accompanied by parental anger or negative comments that assault a child, the healthy developmental shame of a child simply learning to curb his or her behavior now is transformed into more complicated toxic shame and humiliation. One view proposes that toxic shame involves not simply the sense of having done something wrong, which can and needs to be corrected, but the painful sense that one's inner self is defective. And this belief that the self is damaged is felt to be an unchangeable condition of the child, not a behavior that can be modified. Some researchers consider this move from behavior to be changed in the future to a self that is fundamentally flawed as the outcome for children who experience repeated parental hostility in response to their behavior. Toxic shame and humiliation can continue through childhood and into adulthood, even beneath the surface of awareness, leaving individuals with a hidden secret that they are permanently and deeply defective. A cascade of negative consequences, having trouble with close relationships that might reveal this hidden secret, feeling unworthy, being driven to succeed in life but never feeling satisfied, can then dominate the individual's life. You as a parent can avoid giving your child this negative cascade of toxic shame by learning how to create needed structure without humiliating your child. That's an achievable goal, and we are committed to making that path available to you if you choose it. What it all comes down to is that no drama discipline encourages kids to look inside themselves, consider the feelings of others, and make decisions that are often difficult, even when they have the impulse or desire to do things another way. It allows children to put into practice the emotional and social abilities we want them to understand and master. It allows you to create structure with respect. When we're willing to lovingly set a boundary, just like when we discipline with an awareness that our children's brains are changing, changeable, and complex, we help create neural connections that improve our kids' capacity for relationships, self-control, empathy, personal insight, morality, and much, much more. And they can feel good about who they are as individuals while learning to modify their behavior. All of this leads to an exciting conclusion for parents. Every time our children misbehave, they give us an opportunity to understand them better and get a better sense of what they need help learning. Children often act out because they haven't yet developed skills in a particular area. So when your 3-year-old pulls her classmate's hair because he got the first Dixie cup full of fish crackers, she's actually telling you, "I need to build skills in waiting my turn." Likewise, when your 7-year-old becomes defiant and calls you Fartface Jones after you tell him it's time to leave his playdate, he's actually saying, "I need skill building when it comes to handling myself well and communicating my disappointment respectfully when I don't get my way." By misbehaving, kids actually communicate to us what they need help working on, what has not yet been developed, or what specific skills they need practice with. The bad news is that it's rarely much fun, either for the child or for the parent. The good news is that we get information we might not otherwise receive. The even better news is that we can then take intentional steps to give our kids experiences that help them improve on their ability to share, think of others, speak kindly, and so on. We're not saying that when your children don't handle things well, you should necessarily celebrate. Yay, an opportunity to help a brain develop optimally with my intentional response. You're probably not going to enjoy discipline or look forward to future meltdowns. But when you realize that these misbehavior moments aren't just miserable experiences to endure, but actually opportunities for knowledge and growth, you can reframe the whole experience and recognize it as a chance to build the brain and create something meaningful and significant in your child's life.
Chapter 3. From Tantrum to Tranquility. Connection is the key. Michael heard voices rising in his son's room, but was watching the basketball game on TV and decided to wait for a commercial before investigating. Big mistake. His 8-year-old Graham and Graham's friend James had spent the last 30 minutes carefully organizing and categorizing Graham's hundreds of Lego pieces. Graham had used his allowance to buy a fishing tackle box, and he had designated a different compartment for every Lego head, torso, helmet, sword, lightsaber, wand, axe, and anything else the creative geniuses from Denmark could dream up. The boys were in organizational heaven. The problem was that Michael's 5-year-old, Matthias, had been feeling increasingly left out by Graham and James. The three boys had begun the project together, but the older boys eventually felt that Matthias didn't quite understand their complex categorical system. As a result, they weren't allowing him to participate in the activity. Cue the rising voices. Michael never made it to the commercial. The shouting let him know that he needed to intervene immediately, but he wasn't quick enough. When he was still 3 steps away from the boys' room, 3 short steps, he heard the unmistakable sound of hundreds of plastic Lego pieces exploding across a hardwood floor. 3 steps later, he witnessed the mayhem and carnage. It was a complete massacre. Decapitated heads littered the entire room, lying next to armless bodies and weapons both medieval and futuristic. A rainbow of chaos stretched from the doorway to the closet on the other side of the room. Next to the upended tackle box stood Michael's huffing, red-faced 5-year-old, looking at him with eyes that were somehow both defiant and terrified. Michael turned to his older son, who yelled, "He ruins everything!" and ran from the room in tears, followed by a sheepish-looking and uncomfortable James. Talk about a discipline moment. Both of his boys were now bawling. A friend was caught in the crossfire, and Michael himself felt furious. Not only had Matthias destroyed all the work the older boys had done, but now there was a huge mess to clean up in the room. If you've ever felt the pain of stepping on a Lego piece, you know why it wasn't an option to leave the bits spread out on the floor. And he was missing the game. Michael decided he'd go check on the older boys in a minute and address Matthias first. His initial inclination was to stand over his young son, wag his finger in his son's face, and scold him for dumping the tackle box. In his anger, he wanted to offer immediate consequences. He wanted to shout, "Why did you do this?" He wanted to say something about never again getting to participate in Graham's playdates, then add, "Do you see why they didn't want you to play with their Legos?" Luckily, though, the thinking part of Michael, his upstairs brain, took over, and he addressed the situation from a whole brain perspective. What triggered the more mature and empathic approach was his recognition of how much his little boy needed him right then. Of course, Michael would have to address Matthias's behavior. And yes, he'd obviously need to be a bit more proactive next time in attending to the situation before it spun out of control. He'd want to help Matthias think about how Graham felt and understand that our actions often impact other people in significant ways. All of this teaching, all of this redirection, was absolutely necessary, but not right now. Right now, he needed to connect. Matthias was completely dysregulated emotionally, and he needed his dad to soothe the hurt feelings, sadness, and anger that came from being criticized for being too little to understand and from being excluded. This was not the time to redirect, to teach, or to talk about family rules and respect for others' property. It was time to connect. So Michael knelt down and opened his arms, and Matthias fell into them. Michael held him as he sobbed, rubbed his back, and said nothing other than an occasional, "I know, buddy, I know." A minute later, Matthias looked up at him, his eyes shiny with tears, and said, I spilled the Legos. In response, Michael laughed a little bit and said, "I'd say you did more than that, little man." Matthias cracked a small smile, and at that point, Michael knew he could now proceed to the redirecting part of the discipline and help Matthias understand some important lessons about empathy and appropriate expressions of big feelings. He was now capable of hearing his father. Michael's connection and comfort had allowed his son to move out of a reactive state and into a receptive one, where he could hear his dad and really learn. Notice that connecting first is not only more relational and loving, yes, it allows parents to attune to their children, as Michael did here, and be emotionally responsive when they're upset and dysregulated. That enables the child to feel felt, which is the inner sense of being seen and understood that transforms chaos into calm, isolation into connection. Connecting first is a fundamentally loving way to discipline. But notice how much more effective a no-drama disciplinary approach can be as well. It's not that a lecture would have been wrong as Michael's initial response to the situation. Our point here isn't about the rightness or wrongness of parenting approaches, although we definitely argue that a whole brain approach is fundamentally more loving and compassionate. The point is that Michael's connect first tactic achieved the two goals of discipline, gaining cooperation and brain building, extremely effectively. It allowed learning to occur, teaching to be effective, and connection to be established and maintained. His approach let Michael get his son's attention and to do so quickly and without drama, so they could talk about Matthias's behavior in such a way that he could listen. Plus, it could help build Matthias's brain, because he could now hear Michael's points and understand the important lessons his father was teaching him. In addition, Michael modeled for his son a tuned connection and showed him that there are calmer, more loving ways to interact when you're upset with someone. And all of this happened because Michael connected first before redirecting. Proactive parenting. We'll talk in just a minute about why connection is such a powerful tool when our kids are upset or having trouble making good decisions. Michael obviously used it effectively. But by being just a bit slow to respond to the situation, three short steps, he missed an opportunity to avoid the entire disciplinary process completely. It really is true. At times we can avoid having to discipline at all, simply by parenting proactively rather than reactively. When we parent proactively, we watch for times we can tell that misbehavior and or a meltdown is in our children's near future. It's just over the horizon of where they are right now, and we step in and try to guide them around that potential landmine. Michael wanted to make it to the next commercial, so he didn't respond quickly enough to the signs that trouble was beginning to surface in his son's room. Parenting proactively can make all the difference. When, for example, your sweet and usually compliant 8-year-old is getting ready to go to her swim lesson, you might notice that she overreacts a bit when it's time to apply sunscreen. "Why do I have to use sunscreen every day?" Then, while you're getting her little brother ready, she sits down at the piano for a minute to play one of her songs. But she misses a couple of notes, then slams her fist on the keyboard in frustration. You could interpret these actions as isolated incidents and overlook them. Or you could recognize them for the warning flags they probably are. You might remember that this particular daughter gets especially upset when she's hungry, so you might stop what you're doing and set an apple in front of her. When she looks up at you, you can offer her a knowing smile as a reminder of this tendency of hers, and hopefully she'll nod, eat the apple, and move back into a place of self-control. Granted, sometimes no obvious signs present themselves before our kids make bad decisions and act in ways that aren't ideal. But other times we can read our children's cues and take proactive steps to stay ahead of the discipline curve. That might mean giving a warning 5 minutes before having to leave the park, or enforcing a consistent bedtime so your kids don't get too tired and grumpy. It might mean starting to tell a preschooler a suspenseful story and then pausing it, explaining that you'll tell what happens next once she's in her car seat. Or maybe it means you step in to begin a new game when you hear that your children are moving toward significant conflict with each other. It might mean telling a toddler with a voice full of intriguing energy, "Hey, before you throw that French fry across the restaurant, I want to show you what I have in my purse." Another way to parent proactively is to halt before responding to your kids. When you see your child's behavior trending in a direction you don't like, ask yourself, is he H, hungry, A, angry, L, lonely, or T, tired? Halt. Hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. It may be that all you need to do is to set out some raisins, listen to his feelings, play a game with him, or help him get more sleep. Sometimes, in other words, all you need to do is a bit of forethought and planning ahead. Parenting proactively isn't easy, and it takes a fair amount of awareness on your part. But the more you can watch for the beginnings of negative behaviors and head them off at the pass, the less you'll end up having to pick up the literal or figurative pieces, meaning you and your children will have more time simply to enjoy each other. As we all know, though, Sometimes misbehavior just happens. Oh, does it happen? And no amount of proactivity can prevent it. That's when it's time to connect. We have to fight the urge to immediately punish, lecture, lay down the law, or even positively redirect right away. Instead, we need to connect. Why connect first? Let's get more specific and talk about why connection is so powerful. We'll look at three primary benefits: one short-term, one long-term, and one relational, of making connection our first response when our kids have trouble controlling themselves and making good decisions. Benefit number one. Connection moves a child from reactivity to receptivity. However we decide to specifically respond when our children misbehave, there's one thing we have to do. We must remain emotionally connected with them, even when, and perhaps especially when, we discipline. After all, it's when our kids are most upset that they need us the most. Think about it. They don't want to feel frustrated, enraged, or out of control. That's not only unpleasant, it's extremely stressful. Usually, misbehavior is the result of a child having a hard time dealing with what's going on around her and inside her. She's got all these big feelings she doesn't yet have the capacity to manage, and the misbehavior is simply the result. Her actions, especially when she's out of control, are a message that she needs help. They are a bid for assistance and for connection. So when children feel furious, dejected, ashamed, embarrassed, overwhelmed, or out of control in any other way, that's when we need to be there for them. Through connection, we can soothe their internal storm, help them calm down, and assist them in making better decisions. When they feel our love and acceptance, when they feel felt by us, even when they know we don't like their actions or they don't like ours, they can begin to regain control and allow their upstairs brains to engage again. When that happens, effective discipline can actually take place. Connection, in other words, moves them out of a reactive state and into a state where they can be more receptive to the lesson we want to teach and to the healthy interactions we want to share with them. It goes something like this. Discipline is about teaching. And teaching requires kids to be receptive to learning. Receptivity results from connection, and connection moves kids from reactivity to receptivity. So there's a great question we can ask ourselves before we begin redirecting and explicitly teaching. Is my child ready? Ready to hear me? Ready to learn? Ready to understand? If a child isn't ready, then more connection is most likely in order. As we saw with Michael and his 5-year-old, connection calms the nervous system, soothing children's reactivity in the moment and moving them toward a place where they can hear us, learn, and even make their own whole brain decisions. When the emotional gauge gets turned up, connection is the modulator that keeps the feelings from getting too high. Without connection, emotions can continue to spiral out of control. In other words, connection calms. Imagine the last time you felt really sad or angry or upset. How would it have felt if someone you love told you, "You need to calm down," or "It's not that big a deal"? Or what if you were told to go be by yourself until you're calm and ready to be nice and happy? These responses would feel awful, wouldn't they? Yet these are the kinds of things we tell our kids all the time. When we do, we actually increase their internal distress, leading to more acting out, not less. These responses accomplish the opposite of connection, effectively amplifying negative states. Connection, on the other hand, calms, allowing children to begin to regain control of their emotions and bodies. It allows them to feel felt, and this empathy soothes the sense of isolation or being misunderstood that arises with the reactivity of their downstairs brain and the whole nervous system. Heart pounding, lungs rapidly breathing, muscles tightening, and intestines churning. Those reactive states are uncomfortable, and they can become intensified with further demands and disconnection. With connection, however, kids can make more thoughtful choices and handle themselves better. What connection does, essentially, is to integrate the brain. Here's how it works. The brain, as we've said, is complex. That's the third brain C. It's made up of many parts, all of which have different jobs to do. The upstairs brain, the downstairs brain. The left side and the right side. There are memory centers and pain regions. Along with all the systems and circuitry of the brain, these parts of our brain have their own responsibilities, their own jobs to do. When they work together as a coordinated whole, the brain becomes integrated. Its many parts can perform as a team, accomplishing more and being more effective than they could working on their own. As we explained in The Whole Brain Child, a good image to help understand integration is a river of well-being. Imagine you're in a canoe, floating along in a peaceful, idyllic river. You feel calm, relaxed, and ready to deal with whatever comes along. It's not necessarily that everything's perfect or going your way. It's more that you're in an integrated state of mind. You're calm, receptive, and balanced, and your body feels energetic and at ease. Even when things don't work out the way you'd like, you can flexibly adapt. That's the river of well-being. Sometimes, though, you're not able to stay in the flow of the river. You veer too far to one bank or the other. One side of the river represents chaos. Near this bank are dangerous rapids that make life feel frenzied and unmanageable. When you're near the chaos bank, you're easily upset, and even minor obstacles can leave you spinning out of control. You might experience overwhelming emotions, such as high anxiety or intense anger, and you might notice that your body feels chaotic too, with tense muscles, a rapid heartbeat, and a furrowed brow. The other bank is no less unpleasant because it represents rigidity. Here, you get stuck desiring or expecting the world to operate in one particular way, and you're unwilling or unable to adapt when it doesn't. In your effort to impose your own vision and desires on the world around you, you find that you won't, or possibly even can't, compromise or negotiate in any meaningful way. So chaos is on one bank, rigidity on the other. The two extremes offer either a lack of control or so much control that there's no flexibility or adaptability. And both extremes keep you out of the peaceful flow of the river of well-being. Whether you're chaotic or rigid, you're missing out on the opportunity to enjoy mental and emotional health, to feel at ease with the world. Think about the river of well-being in relation to your kids. Almost always, when children act up or feel upset, they will display evidence of chaos, rigidity, or both. When a 9-year-old freaks out about an oral presentation at school the next day and ends up ripping up her notes as she sobs that she'll never be able to memorize her opening, she succumbed to chaos. She's crashed into the bank, far from the smooth, flowing river of well-being. Similarly, when a 5-year-old stubbornly insists on another bedtime story or refuses to get in the tub until he finds his most special wristband, he's right up against the rigidity bank. And remember Nina from the last chapter? when she fell apart because her mom told her that her dad would be driving her to school that morning, then refused to consider any alternative perspectives on the situation, she was zigzagging back and forth between chaos and rigidity, never getting to enjoy the peaceful flow in the center of the river of well-being. So that's what connection does. It moves children away from the banks and back into the flow, where they experience an internal sense of balance and feel happier and more stable. Then they can hear what we need to tell them, and they can make better decisions. When we connect with a child who feels overwhelmed and chaotic, we help move her away from that bank and into the center of the river, where she can feel more balanced and in control. When we connect with a child who's stuck in a rigid frame of mind, unable to consider alternative perspectives, we help him integrate so that he can loosen his unyielding grip on a situation and become more flexible and adaptive. In both cases, connection creates an integrated state of mind and the opportunity for learning. We'll get much more specific in the next chapter about practical ways to connect with your children when they're upset. The basic approach, though, usually entails listening and providing lots of verbal and nonverbal empathy. This is how we attune to our children, tuning into the inner life of their mind, to their feelings and thoughts, to their perceptions and memories, to what has inner subjective meaning in their lives. This is tuning into the mind beneath their behavior. For example, one of the most powerful ways we connect with our children is simply by physically touching them. A loving touch, as simple as a hand on an arm or a rub on the back or a warm embrace, releases feel-good hormones, like natural oxytocin and opioids, into our brain and body and decreases the level of our stress hormone cortisol. When your children are feeling upset, a loving touch can calm things down and help you connect, even during moments of high stress. This is connecting with their inner distress, not simply reacting to their outwardly visible behavior. Connection moves a child from reactivity to receptivity. Even saying something like, "I know, buddy," and hugging a child can help them calm down. Notice that this was the first thing Michael did when he looked at his young son in the middle of the Lego carnage. He sat down and held him. In doing so, he began to pull Matthias's tiny canoe away from the bank of chaos and back into the peaceful flow of the river. Then he listened. Matthias didn't need to say much. "I spilt the Legos." With that, he could begin to move on. Sometimes children will need to talk much more and to be listened to for much longer. Or sometimes they don't want to talk. And sometimes it can be as quick as it was here. Nonverbal touch, an empathic statement, "I know, buddy," and a willingness to listen. That's what Matthias needed in order to return some equilibrium to his young brain and impulsive body. Once that happened, his father could begin to teach him by talking about the lessons at hand. Even though Michael wasn't thinking in these terms, what he was doing was using his relationship, his connecting communication, to help bring integration to Matthias's brain, so that his upstairs brain and his downstairs brain could work together, and so that the right and left sides of his brain could work together. When Matthias became furious with the older boys, his downstairs brain completely took over, disabling his upstairs brain. The instinctive, reactive, lower parts of his brain became so active that he lost access to the higher parts of the brain, the ones that help him think about consequences and consider others' feelings. These two parts of his brain were not working together. In other words, his brain in that moment was disintegrated, and the result was the Lego massacre. By offering a nonverbal gesture instead of just a bunch of logical left brain words, Michael was able to connect with Matthias's right brain, the side more directly connected to and also flooded by the downstairs brain. Right and left, downstairs and upstairs, Matthias's brain was ready to become more coordinated and balanced in its movement toward integration. Connection integrated his emotion-focused downstairs brain and his thinking-oriented upstairs brain and allowed Michael